situated. I do want to say one comment, which is before you begin, if you would please pronounce your name and that of your party for us, maybe slowly with some assistance, depending on what the name is, so we can get that correct. And also let us know how you'd like to refer to you and your client during the argument. Ms. Carlson, are you prepared to proceed? You can have a few minutes. I know you're plugging things in and getting situated, so just let us know when you're ready. Take your time. I don't want to rush you. So whenever you're ready, we're ready for you.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Ann M. Carlson, and I represent Appellant Father S.S. We are asking that this court would reverse the Hennepin County Juvenile Court's order terminating my client's parental rights and remand with instructions to facilitate reunification. And in following your instruction just now, I'm comfortable being referred to as appellant throughout oral argument. Thank you. The best interest of the children's standard, by its very nature, requires a subjective evaluation of a multitude of factors, many of which are imbued with the values of majority culture in re-custody of SEG 521 and W2D 357 at 362 Minnesota 1994. When evaluating the best interests of the children, the district court is required to weigh three factors: the parent's interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship, the children's interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship, and any competing interests. Competing interests include stability, health considerations, and children's preferences. In this case, the facts outlined and agreed upon by the court are that my client, SS, has an interest in maintaining his parental rights to his children. The children at this age are, I believe, 11, 9, and one will be 3 years old coming up October 1st. For an 11 and a 9-year-old child that have a bond with their father, and as detailed by the district court, these children also have an interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship. The reports are that father behaved appropriately at visitation, that they have a loving relationship, and the court even found that it would be in these children's best interests that they maintain some sort of contact with their father going forward.
Go ahead. But that's different from placing children in full-time care and custody and control of a parent. You know, my concern here is these children haven't lived with father for 2 years, and he is not, I think, you acknowledge he's not complied with his case plans that are premised on his chemical abuse. So I understand your argument about best interests being a varied multi-factor thing, and I think the district court here did look at it from all those perspectives. But it's hard for me to get to the conclusion of abuse of discretion given the safety, stability risks involved in having an untreated, chemically dependent parent having full-time custody and control.
I anticipated that this court would question an argument based on best interest of the child when generally it's not susceptible to appellate review as it involves a global review of the record, including credibility determinations. And this court is not in a position to challenge credibility determinations, which are solely in the purview of the district court.
And I don't mean to interrupt you, but I mean, I understand. I mean, yes, it's abuse of discretion is a difficult standard, but what is it about the evidence here, or is there something in the law that would permit this court to find abuse of discretion or get to your argument, to accept your argument on a record like this where you've had a parent who's not had care and control of children for 2 years and has not addressed his chemical health problems?
Well, Your Honor, I look to one of my favorite cases in Reed JBO, which is an unpublished case of this court from 2019, where this court made a finding. The government does not always know what's best for children. And in that case, father had, it was without contest, he had been convicted of sexually abusing one of his children. I believe it was a 16-year-old female, and there was a long history of that. However, this court reversed based on the fact that the best interest factors simply did not support a termination of father's parental rights. And in that case, which I would say has worse facts ultimately than this case, we had children who expressed that they did not want parental rights to be terminated to their father, who was in prison, who was not able to provide their day-to-day care. And we had both parents.
They live with their mother, didn't they?
You're correct, Your Honor.
That's significant, right? They do have a parent. And didn't we also in that case acknowledge that this was an extraordinary case, the circumstances of JBO?
You did. It was an extraordinary case for an extraordinary family with extraordinary children who, by all accounts, were doing very well. The mother was getting these children the special assistance that they needed by way of counseling. I believe the children were taking college courses while they were still in their youth. Yes, it was an extraordinary case.
And what makes this case similarly extraordinary that we would say, you know, the district court abused its discretion in determining that the best interests support termination?
Well, my concern in reading the best interest analysis in this case is I do not find it to be an individualized analysis regarding these three children. And that was one of the court's arguments in JBO, was that we had two differently situated children, girl and boy, and that the court basically made a blanket analysis that these children would be best served by a termination of parental rights without looking at the way that girl was differently situated than boy. Now, we have two children that are of an age where it is not in dispute that they have an interest in maintaining the parent-child relationship, the two older children, and the court acknowledges that. And what I think is extraordinary in this case is that when looking at the best interest factors, and you have the two factors of the parent's interest and the child's interest, both of those weigh in favor of maintaining parental rights. Health considerations, which I brought those up in my brief as those are part of the three-part additional factors, health considerations, children's preferences, and stability are the competing interests that are the third part of the best interest analysis. And in this case, the court says the father actually did meet the children's health considerations. I mean, the court makes a finding that I believe one of the children needed glasses, excuse me, at the time of removal, and another child had an issue with walking on his tiptoes. But that was not the cause of the removal here. So the only remaining factor that, and the one that the court relies on heavily, is stability.
So if I can jump in here, because I do think that there are cases, as you know, where a party is not even able to do well in those supervised visitation circumstances. That's not the case here. It doesn't appear to be. And so the real question then comes is, what if, as in this case, there is some part of the case plan that a party is struggling to comply with, and that's the reason that you never expand from supervised visitation? What have we said as a court? What has the Supreme Court said about how a district court is supposed to determine best interests when the party is limited but doing well in their contact with the children? Have we ever said that a district court can't extrapolate from that because there's such a difference between supervised visitation and placement? Is there any authority that says the district court can't do what it did?
Your Honor, I understand that the district court has broad discretion when it comes to issuing a determination that it is in the children's best interest that parental rights be terminated. And I am asking that this court would reverse the district court's order and remand with instructions to facilitate reunification. I understand that, generally speaking, the district court has very broad discretion, but that is the argument that I am making, is I'm asking for a reversal on the basis that me reading this argument leads me to the conclusion that it is in these children's best interest, these specific children's best interest, that there not be a termination of parental rights and that these children not be subjected to an uncertain future in foster care. We do ourselves a disservice when we think of foster care as being this place where children will find safety and stability, while we full well know that it may take years for children to find safety and stability in foster care, if ever, and that we are dealing with a foster care system that is inundated with thousands of children that are looking for placement. A termination of parental rights is a grave and weighty matter, and it should only be issued when other statutory remedies have failed. In this case, the children were removed because the mother had prenatal exposure to substances.
Well, that's what caused the agency to start investigating, but the investigation quickly led them to both parents have significant chemical health problems.
Correct. Right?
I mean, that's why the children were removed on an emergency basis, because they could not be safely placed with either parent. Right?
I believe that that comes back to the values of majority culture. There needs to be a causal nexus between a parent's use and their inability to provide a safe home for the children. Now, the court does make a very... I appreciate the court's order in this case. I appreciate that the court took and made a thoughtful analysis regarding Minnesota Statute 260C, 0.301 sub 1B, neglect of parental duties, and 260C, 0.301 sub 1B4. Palpable unfitness to parent, and ultimately found that the issues that arose in this case were insufficient to meet the agency's burden of proof in a termination of parental rights matter. But I believe that same analysis follows through to subparent 5, failure to correct the conditions that led to out-of-home placement, which I believe this court correctly identified were that mother was exposed to substances, but when there's substance
use... Well, the youngest child was born positive, right?
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just not seeing the causal nexus between the parent's use and the parent's inability to provide a home for the children.
And maybe I can get back to the kind of the sort of backbone here. The authority for requiring a causal nexus... What's that case, and what is that? Isn't that restricted, perhaps, to palpable unfitness?
Your Honor, causal nexus. Fortunately, I'm going to have about 15 minutes coming up, and I have about 90 cases.
That's okay.
Printed
it's okay.
Off,
I don't.
So
mean to
I would
put you
be happy to get you an answer.
I don't mean to put you on the spot. I guess my question is more: have we extended that requirement of a causal connection into other statutory bases than palpable unfitness.
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, and it will take me a bit of time to get back to this court.
Ms. Carlson, can I dovetail off of that? The court
please.
Also made the findings as allowed in this particular statutory basis, the rebuttable presumption. And so it almost seems on its face that it is a different analysis than the palpable unfitness as a result. And so what do we do with that? The fact that would you agree the record supports the rebuttable presumption, and doesn't that leave us with, well, was it rebutted? And it seems like it really wasn't in terms of the factual findings, unless there's something in the record that you think's missing from a factual finding that it somehow was rebutted. So wouldn't that pretty much satisfy the abuse of discretion in terms of the statutory basis?
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, the rebuttable presumption, and speaking of 260C.301, to me, the rebuttable presumption is always palpable unfitness to parent under subparent 4, and the court found the presumption applies under subparent 5.
Well, it's related, right, to the treatment efforts and failures and out-of-home and length of the children and so forth.
Correct. And I'm not making the argument that the presumption was rebutted in this case, and will further look into rebutting a presumption that's established under subparagraph 5. I apologize. My argument is the most important part of any termination of parental rights order is the individualized determination that the children's best interests are served by a termination of parental rights, and that in this case, the court made a lot of conclusory findings about how the children would be best served by having a safe, stable caregiver and being in a home that is drug-free. I think when we make findings like that, we are undermining the purpose of the best interest determination, speak to these specific children and why these specific children should be subjected to a severing of ties with the only biological parent that is still in their lives. Are there any further questions? Thank you very much. And I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Go ahead, Mr. Peters.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent, the Hennepin County Human Services Department, this morning. And respondent, or county, or department are just fine descriptions for the client. I have a few brief comments I'd like to make about this appeal, and then I'm more than happy to answer any questions that this panel still has. With respect to the best interest of the child analysis, there's that JBO decision that Ms. Carlson again referenced this morning and also had referenced in her brief, that 2019 decision, non-precedential decision from this court. And as Judge Bjorkman and Ms. Carlson were discussing before, there are some significant differences between that case and what we have here. The children there were older. There was a 15 and a 17-year-old, two children in that case, as compared to three children younger than age 10 in this case. And as Judge Bjorkman also mentioned, this court specifically called that case extraordinary in its opinion, and for good reason. The two teenagers in that case were both quite shockingly and honestly, thankfully, doing extremely well. They were fully supported and cared for by mom, who still had her full parental rights, and both of those teenagers expressly wanted their father's parental rights to remain intact. And as was mentioned before, too, the father in that case was serving a prison sentence where he was going to be in prison for at least 7 years past when this court considered that appeal, which means he did not pose any safety risk to the teenager's upbringing at that time. None of those circumstances are present in this case.
One of the points that Ms. Carlson made, and I think it's well taken, is that the district court has to do more than just discuss the factors, but that the best interest analysis needs to be individualized and particularized to the children involved and the parent involved in the case. How do you respond to her argument that in fact, the district court did not do that here?
I think the district court did do that, and I'll use JBO as a comparison to make that point. In JBO, there was a male teenager and a female teenager, and obviously the female teenager, if you dig into the facts of that case, was sexually assaulted by father.
For years.
Yes. Very different situation than we have here. So the individual analysis based on the wrongdoing by that particular individual toward one child as opposed to the other was substantial, and it did need to be individually analyzed. Here we have younger children, and I'm not saying that raising a 2-year-old is the same as raising a 7 or 8-year-old. I have both of those, and I understand that they are very different. But at the same time, creating a living situation where the sole caregiver is chemically dependent on methamphetamine, using methamphetamine, making decisions that are chemically imbalanced by methamphetamine, that is going to impact the care and the safety of the environment for a 2-year-old just as much as it is going to impact for a 7-year-old. So I think with respect to the specific facts that Judge Kapelhoff was addressing in this case, I think he did adequately analyze the safety with respect to all three of the children under the best interest of the child analysis.
Do you see any issue with the best interest analysis really being derivative of whether or not somebody has progressed beyond supervised visits?
I think, is that similar to the question that you asked Ms. Carlson before, Judge Bryan?
Yes.
And yet, I'm not aware of any of case law that requires, like, extrapolating how successful those supervised visits were going, which I think the record and Judge Kaplhoff's findings make clear. We're going quite well in this case. But it's obviously very different to jump from those limited supervised visits for short periods of time into being the sole care provider for children. So I think to go back to your question, I'm not aware of anything that would require Judge Kaplhoff or any district court judge to use the success of those supervised visits and extrapolate out from them and to assume or hope that the outcome would be the same if the person in those supervised visits was given 24-hour responsibility for care.
Well, I guess the question I'm asking is that you could conceivably have a problem complying, or a person could have a problem complying with the case plan for a variety of reasons, and that it's that that non-compliance that then results in not being able to move past supervised visits. And it's not being able to move past supervised visits that then becomes a barrier to having any, to prevailing on a best interest standard. So the question, I guess, goes back to, is there something that the county or the court needs to do when evaluating whether to move someone beyond supervised visitation in order to give that person an opportunity to prevail on the best interest findings?
I think that there's nothing in case law or the statute that absolutely requires that. If we dig into the facts specific in this case, I think if appellant had satisfied several of those case plan steps, for instance, submitting a negative urine analysis or demonstrating some sort of period of sustained sobriety or something that showed that he was capable of doing more than just having limited supervised visits with his children, that would have been, it would have put appellant in a much stronger position to
arguably
request.
Arguably, he showed he was capable of more than the supervised visits through his behavior and performance at those supervised visits.
I guess
the question then, I think, is really what goes into the best interest analysis, and can you, as a district court, and make this determination of best interest on the basis of the fact that the only contact was limited and supervised?
I think that the problem here is, being contrasting it to not only JBO but a host of other cases, is that mother already had her parental rights terminated voluntarily. And so in terms of looking to the future of these children as they grew up, I understand your point, Judge Bryan, about needing to try something out further than just the regular schedule of supervised visits, because those were going well. But the children wanted, besides stability, is just a future where they were going to have a more permanent situation. And obviously, appellant was nowhere close to having that ability to permanently care for them because of the failure to take those steps that were outlined in the case plan, as we've already discussed.
Can I ask you about that? Or, I'm sorry, you finish your thought. And
then no, I'll, Judge Sleater, go ahead.
Finish your, okay. It kind of ties into that. It wasn't real clear to me, and maybe that's because we're at the TPR, we're not reviewing the child protection, but there was a, and we see this often, a reference or notice of all these other facts from the child protection case. But I couldn't tell if father was actually in the home with mother at the time this prenatal emergency led to intervention. And part of this ties into both this best interest issue. If he's never had any real opportunity to parent, then while causal connection may not be directly required, it certainly seems, when you look at the statutory basis, the condition leading to the children taken from the home, if it's from mother's home, then obviously it wasn't his chemical dependency. It was hers that led to them being taken out and then led to the years of the program and case plan.
There will be two different versions of what the living situation was in early October of 2019 when there was that prenatal test and the umbilical cord came up positive for methamphetamine. And one version comes from appellant, in which he was living separate from the mother and the children. And I believe he said or told the child protection investigator, Ms. Washington, that they were living with the mother's mother, so with the grandma to the kids. The two older children, who at the time were age 5 and age 7, were also interviewed by that child protection investigator at school. And the version of events that the children provided is that they actually were all living together. Both mother and father were living together, and they were living at a hotel, specifically at Days Inn. So I don't believe Judge Kapoff made a specific factual finding deciding that discrepancy. The children did not testify at the termination of parental rights trial. An appellant did. But those are the two versions that were out there. In terms of the causal nexus, and returning to a point that Judge Bryan had made earlier when Ms. Carlson was up here before, the reason that causal nexus appears in this court's precedent regarding palpable unfitness is because of the statutory language in Subdivision 1B4, the palpable unfitness statutory ground. And that says that a consistent pattern of specific conduct before the child or specific conditions directly relating to the parent and child relationship. So there is that causal nexus that's baked into the statutory language, which is why this court has appropriately and repeatedly required that showing when there's a move to terminate someone's parental rights based on palpable unfitness. But that language does not appear in the statutory ground that is before us today, which is 1B5.
Presumably that's part of why the court dismissed that particular, that was one of the statutory bases, if I recall.
Exactly. So not only is that consistent, but that is why Judge Kapoff reached the decision that he did here. And Judge Slater, you mentioned before about those rebuttable presumptions. Both of them were satisfied here. And when they were satisfied, there's been no argument that they were not satisfied. And because of that, because the outcome is that there's an effective presumption that the existence of those circumstances does negatively impact the parent's ability to care for the child. And specific to this case, it was because that it was negatively impacted because it made for an unsafe living environment. Judge Bryan, I realized that I was attempting to ask you a question before and I got sidetracked. Did you get a satisfactory answer, or do you want to try one more time?
I think you've answered it to a large extent. It is still troubling to me that if you take out the causal connection piece and restrict that, that's now limited to palpable unfitness. Now, when you're looking at a best interest standard as we have here under a different statutory basis, you can be kind of removed a little bit if the best interest findings are based on some determination that the parent, while doing well in supervised visits, isn't doing well enough, or these other aspects of the case plan haven't been met, and that's why that there's a best interest on stability or whatever general value you want to look at that you can then attach to best interest. I think that is a little troubling, and so I'm wondering if there is any case or any authority or anything from the statutory language that can help guide district courts to know how much weight should they put into the fact that a parent was doing well but they only had supervised visits? Or conversely, how much weight do you put into the case plan?
I think what makes this particular set of facts especially troubling and challenging is because there was no other parent who was going to be able to continue to care for and support the children in that regard?
If that's important, I don't mean to cut you off, but I feel like I'm not so convinced by that, because if that is important, then you'd have one standard when there's a parent involved and a different standard when there isn't. That doesn't seem to be what's intended by our statutes and what is intended by the review that district courts
and I wouldn't
give
go as
evidence.
I apologize, Judge Ryan. I wouldn't go as far as saying standard, but I think that comes from those three factors that are part of that best interest analysis in terms of the interests of the children, the interests of the parent, and those are competing considerations in which stability is just one of, in addition to health and others. And I think that it becomes down to a balancing test, and that's why we have an abuse of discretion standard on review, is because a different district court judge may have reached a different decision here. They may have said, these supervised visits are going so well, I want to continue them. One of the requests, actually, from appellant to Judge Kapelhoff was to, rather than terminating parental rights, going back to the child protection stage and just basically trying out more time. I think that Judge Kapelhoff's concern, as I read his order, was the length of time, as this court already made apparent today, that these children had already been without a caregiver, without a parent, like in that care role in their lives beyond these supervised visits. And so, but a different district court judge sitting in that very same place, which I know you have done yourselves, could have reached a different decision, but I don't think it was abuse of discretion to reach the decision that Judge Kapelhoff did, which is ultimately the question that this court is tasked with answering with respect to the best interest analysis. I'm more than happy to try to answer any other questions with the minute that I have left. Hearing none, I would simply ask that this court affirm Judge Kapelhoff's decision to terminate parental rights in this case.
Ms. Carlson.
Thank you, and for the record, Ann Morris Carlson. I represent Appellant Father S.S. I appreciate counsel's arguments, but during that time was reviewing the district court's best interest findings, and I'm still very much struggling with findings that I think you could just apply to any child anywhere. To say that a child needs a safe and stable home, healthy, capable parents, these are findings that you could apply to everyone.
So what findings should the court have made? I mean, I understand your argument that this can't just be a reflexive, I'm repeating the language of the statute. What would appropriate findings look like in a case like this?
To me, appropriate findings would indicate that you have taken into consideration, that the district court has taken into consideration, child one. What about child one? Is there something specific about child one that would indicate that she needs a stable home more than another child, more than child two? Is there something that differentiates child two as having a stronger parental bond that would be worse severing than, say, child three? And you could make that argument that child three would have the easiest time severing the parental bond based on the fact that child three, I believe on the record, has not lived with the father. And then an analysis about the fact that it is in the children's best interest that they maintain a sibling relationship, and therefore some sort of information that would indicate to me that there's consideration of, we have three siblings, two of these siblings have a very strong interest in maintaining a relationship with the father. One sibling has its strongest interest, presumably, would be retaining that relationship with the other siblings. I don't know that the court is allowed to look outside the record. Actually, I know that the court is not allowed to look to the adoptability of the children. But in making a best interest determination, I think that it's very important that there be some indication that the specific children subject to the case have been thoroughly evaluated by the district court.
In your mind, would it ever be enough to just focus on, say, the concerns around a parent, substance abuse, mental illness, and not make some analysis of how that might affect each child differently, but just say, focus on that and make a determination based on that alone? Or is that always going to be something that, in your view, would be abuse of discretion and we would reverse?
I think that there are fact patterns, and this is not one of them, where the case can be well established that it would not be in the best interest of this child or any child to be in the care of this parent based on, say, egregious harm. Under
how far would you go down that path in terms of substance abuse?
Well, I want to make sure that I want to make sure I understand.
At some point, I'm sure you would agree that the substance abuse is so bad that it would impact, as a general matter,
I guess
every parent who has that degree of a substance abuse problem would not be abuse of discretion to terminate. Like, how far down that path can you go? And on substance abuse in particular,
Your Honor, my consideration of substance abuse brings me back to when we talk about the values of majority culture, we can look to the reason that the Indian Child Welfare Act was established as being that we in the majority culture had issues with daily alcohol use and also with education of children that didn't meet the standards of Western Europe. And I would say that if you are using daily, if you are drinking every day all day, but you have family supports in the home that are ensuring that your children's needs are being met, that is a situation where I would say look to the best interests of the children, the support network, everything that is going on in the family as a whole in its entirety before saying that the substance use is enough to find that the parent cannot have the children safely returned to their care.
But isn't that an argument should have been made at the CHIP stage? And there was no appeal of the CHIPS determination, but didn't the CHIPS determination, in fact, link the chemical use to the child's need for protection or services?
The court is correct, and I'm not in a position of challenging the
CHIPS and that wasn't the issue before us. So I'm saying we're in this. I appreciate your argument, but it seems like in this particular case, we've already had that linkage between the need for sobriety or at least not abusing chemicals, and safe care of the children.
If I may have a brief moment to summarize my position.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you. One of my favorite cases by this court is in the matter of the welfare of MAH. Forgive me for using the phrase favorite case because, of course, it is a case that involves children that are in need of protection or services for children, one of whom the parental rights are ultimately terminated. But this court gives a very thoughtful analysis about how the district court did not abuse its discretion when it made the determination to terminate parental rights on the basis of egregious harm with regard to one child. I believe that is PPH, and then not terminate parental rights for the other three children, the three siblings of PPH, on the basis that in that household, their needs were being met. These were foster parents who adopted these children and ultimately did not follow the standards of modern medicine of getting child PPH the need or the care that he needed other than bringing him to a chiropractor. What I appreciate about that case is it lays out, you know, best interest is not solely determinative. There does need to be a statutory basis, but also that best interest requires an analysis of each child's needs. The fact that these findings could be applied to any child in any state, anywhere, is troubling to me. And any best interest finding that just ultimately leads to the conclusion that based on a blanket need for stability, there should be a severing of parental ties, I believe is inadequate. And for that reason, I am asking that this court would reverse the district court's order terminating my client's parental rights and remand with instructions for reunification at the earliest possible time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, the case is received. I want to thank the parties for their arguments, both written and oral. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Good to see everyone.